You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is edition 226. Thanks for tuning in. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with Sam Gould, who is an educator, artist, and community organizer in Minneapolis, Minnesota. This conversation is really focused on hearing Sam's experiences and the communities that he is connected to in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, and particularly around the mobilizations to support those facing the violence of the Trump administration's ICE raids around a region of the city called Powderhorn Park. Sam speaks about the ways that community organizing has played an important role in the response to ICE raids in different cities across the United States. Of course, Minneapolis was key to really pushing back against this violent attack on migrant communities on the part of the American government. And so I thought it would be really meaningful to get a firsthand account of a community organizer with long roots in an important region of Minneapolis, and to really just describe what community organizers have been doing, both on the streets, but also the mutual aid networks that have emerged to support those facing the violence of the ICE crackdowns in Minneapolis, but also across the United States. This type of organizing process, although different in each community, is mirrored in certain ways through grassroots organizing. So on this edition of Free City Radio, I'm sharing with you my conversation with Sam Gould in Minneapolis. Here it is. Sam, the images that you've shared from Minneapolis in the last week in your network of community organizers and artists and activists have been pretty harrowing. We were talking in early February 2026, and I really got a sense of the sort of physical emergency that a lot of people are facing around these ICE raids in Minneapolis. So I want to talk to you about that, but also just sort of zooming out, you know, you're one of many people that has chosen to sort of be present on the streets at a certain level to sort of be with people and to try to encounter this very violent situation. Of course, it's not just Minneapolis, but many cities around the United States right now where immigrant and migrant communities are being targeted. So zooming out, maybe you could just introduce yourself a bit. I understand you're a community worker and artist. You have a family there in Minneapolis, and you've sort of taken that leap to be part of the grassroots response of residents of Minneapolis who are both documenting and protesting these ICE raids. So it'd be great to hear about who you are and then any sort of initial reflections about what you've seen and your experiences.
Yeah, I think just to put this point out very early, I think for the majority of Minneapolitans, it's not necessarily a choice. It's so, this situation is unavoidable. You can attempt to avoid it and you'll still, encounter it. So it's not really a matter of people thinking, oh, do I want to get involved in this? It's really more, can I get away from this if that is your predilection. It's omnipresent. In my neighborhood in particular, I live in South Minneapolis in a neighborhood called Powderhorn Park, which is named after our park, Powderhorn, which is a block from my house. My area of Minneapolis is contiguous to East Lake Street, which is a main artery that runs through South Minneapolis across the Mississippi River into St. Paul. And it's historically, you know, at least for the last 100 years or so, really been a place of entanglement and beginnings for large groups of people coming from many different experiences, cultures, races, economic classes. There's two wonderful books by a neighbor who grew up here in the 30s and 40s, Nelson Peary, who was a black communist who lived just about a quarter of a mile south of my house, closer to George Floyd Square, where George Floyd was murdered. And he, in his first memoir, Black Fire, talks about going to South High School. This is where my kids go. And there's just a snippet of him talking about in the 1930s going to South. And I read it and I was like, oh my God, he could be talking about my kids' experience. You know, some of the cultures have changed, but those sorts of entanglements and energy and friction and sense of this is our place in a very polyglot, heterogeneous way rhymed nearly 100 years later. So that's kind of a sense of our neighborhood. And I would argue one of the reasons, really maybe the main reason Trump and his minions have zeroed in on this place, our home, because it represents a future America that they're desperately attempting to stop in some way. We are a living metaphor of a polyglot United States that is inevitable, and it's anathema to them. It strikes as such an insult to their kind of Protestant Christian whiteness, which is not at all what this neighborhood is. This neighborhood is all different cultures, and well, not everyone obviously, but just many different cultures, many different races, different sexual orientations, and it's very open and critical and questioning and creative. It's one of the reasons where when I arrived here, my wife grew up in Minneapolis, not far from where we live. I'm from New York City originally. When we moved here, this really was the only place I could think of living. I felt welcomed here. It felt like home. It felt like what I think not just a city is supposed to be, what a neighborhood is supposed to be. Yeah. So, I mean, that's where, in the big picture, that's where we're at. And then within this also, you know, I'm an artist and editor. I'm a professor at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. As a space for artists and culture workers in general of all stripes, I love how cultural work really embeds itself within the life of the neighborhood, not as an offshoot, but as part of its ecology, as something that is vital for the energy of this place. It is not seen as secondary in any way. Or even objective, like it is a subjective force.
It's really meaningful to sort of have a sense of this district. Powderhorn Park is the park, but Powderhorn area in Minneapolis. Thank you for sharing that, Sam. And also I think that the distinction you shared in terms of thinking about the raids on the part of ICE as being a reality that's unavoidable is really kind of something to underline from what you shared. So thank you for putting that forth. So maybe could you talk a little bit about some of these grassroots actions that have been taking place? Because obviously, yes, people are encountering this reality in terms of, you know, ICE agents showing up in different restaurants or parks or contexts or school pickup, drop off, daycare, pickup, drop off. But there's also clearly an attempt of citizens to come together to document these raids and to be present. So I'd love to just get a sense of what that's been like for you and your experience.
Well, I mean, my last like kind of harrowing experience, rather than just like the consistent slow creep of dread that it's been, was, you know, Tuesday was, I believe, the fourth morning in a row where I was woken up by not just the impulse, but just like this reality of having to run out of my house because ICE was present. On Tuesday, once again, they were circling our block. Really, it seemed kind of to antagonize, almost like a shark would circle prey. They just kept going around, and my family and I were woken up to car horns and whistles, and I ran outside. Two of my kids ran outside, and this car just keeps circling. And then, you know, they have no idea where they are. So he drove down a dead-end alley, and a car followed, and a bunch of neighbors followed. And he's stuck at the end of an alley. We're all closed in on one another. So then, you know, three ICE agents in tactical gear and helmets come out with their weapons drawn, as all of these neighbors are in a standoff with these nonviolent neighbors with no weapons and three armed federal agents pointing guns at us. And we slowly have to figure out how we're not going to run in fear, but we're also not going to get ourselves shot. And my, you know, two of my kids are with me in this situation where I'm then having to think, oh, you know, what do I do here? Where I make sure that, like, my children are safe, too. But my children also feel compelled to protect their neighborhood, protect their neighbors in the only way that any of us can think of, which is to be present, to put ourselves in between this vile force and both literally and metaphorically what they represent. I'd like to say that occurrence has been an anomaly, and I'm kind of shocked by that. That's one of so many different, very similar occurrences that have happened over the last 2 months. But there is a real kind of impulse by everyone to just say, I will not stand idly by this. There are people running out of their homes at every moment. There are people standing on street corners on watch. There are people driving around the neighborhood in a very organized but organically formed manner, wherein we're all talking to one another and patrolling the neighborhood, keeping our eyes on ICE almost 24 hours a day. And this is tens and tens of thousands of people. Along with this, incredible mutual aid efforts. I would argue all of this is mutual aid, but in terms of like practical goods, helping people with rent assistance. My neighborhood, like many other neighborhoods, has started rent assistance funds, wherein we've gotten plenty of other people to donate. As of today, just my neighborhood has been able to raise over $360,000 for neighbors who cannot leave their homes, so we can pay their rent for them. A good friend of mine who teaches at Carleton College, lives in St. Paul, he started off protecting a daycare center down the street from his house. Then it turned out after one of the teachers was abducted, he now drives the teachers to and from work every day. None of these stories are unusual to anyone here on the ground right now. It's just what we're doing.
There's a really important point, I feel, that sort of comes out of what you're describing, which is just to sort of underline a pretty critical idea that popular action can change conversations, right? Like, I think there's a sense that, you know, certain policies are inevitable or certain outcomes inevitable. If we're talking about mainstream media narratives, of course there's important alternatives in the United States, like Democracy Now! And others. But, you know, it's just sort of, I think, interesting to always underline the sort of role that community action can play in changing dynamics. And thinking about that also, because at least here in the Canadian context, we hear from, you know, let's say press clippings where we'll hear like a short statement from the governor of Minnesota or maybe the mayor of Minneapolis. But it's very rare that we hear out from individuals outside of people who've been extremely victimized, or, you know, a family member of you know, somebody who's been detained, which is also important. But we don't hear many voices of people who are kind of there on a grassroots level changing the conversation.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important to share those stories, also because I think this is a global issue. This is an issue of, you know, if we can be technical here, of kind of a ever creeping hegemony that is going all over the world of a very small amount of people governing a huge populace, whether that's the US or Canada, or simply just like the loss of any notion of nation states. And it is purely just kind of the, you know, kind of the technocrats and capitalists running everything. So this is, in sharing those stories outwards, I hope what it can provide is not simply inspiration, but also some tools for how to adapt our experiences on the ground in other social landscapes. Because even in the US, what we're doing here in Minneapolis, for a variety of different reasons, both culture, literally urban design, the geography of space, that's not necessarily going to work in the same way that it will work in Dallas. What we're doing here in Minneapolis is very different than what good friends of mine had been doing in Chicago, or what has been happening in Los Angeles. We all need to respond to our own social landscapes and their particularities. We are doing that here in a way that is very unique to us. It makes a lot of sense to both the geography of this place and the culture of this place, and specifically in the neighborhood here in South Minneapolis, in the neighborhoods that are closest to East Lake Street, generational work. There is a muscle memory, a kind of critical continuum that, like I said at the beginning of when we were talking, goes almost all the way back 100 years. You can read Nelson Peary's books about this kind of collective education and collective experience across cultures, across races, and across time. It should never be forgotten that the American Indian Movement was founded in this neighborhood in response to the abuse of the Minneapolis Police Department. This neighborhood was up in flames 5.5 years ago because of the abuse of the Minneapolis Police Department. 5.5 years later, we now have federal agents who are treating this neighborhood in very much the same way it has been treated for a century. So with that, there is a type of grassroots knowledge that is intuitive, that is shared by people here. And as I said earlier, that also is, that's cultural work in terms of a critical faculty of how you look out for one another, what your values are, but it is also cultural work in that creativity and having kind of cross-cultural connections that buoy one another and lift one another up are a form of how we see one another. These are tools of recognition, and they are tools of shared support.
It's, I think, important to talk about also the idea of infrastructure. There's a cultural and social infrastructure which you're describing, and we're sort of coming, I think, to this moment where a lot of people in sort of progressive community networks are thinking about what does infrastructure look like, because these informal networks have been really capable of responding to crisis moments. But, you know, it's been really challenging to think about beyond the crisis. You know, there's, of course, always examples of numerous projects, particularly in the arts. So maybe this could be a twofold kind of response. I'd love to hear your thoughts about infrastructure. And then also if there's any sort of interesting cultural initiatives or projects or arts-based expressions that you think are important for people to resonate with this with in this moment.
The majority of the work that I do is artwork that I do is that. It has been for, you know, 25 years. But when a few years after moving to Minneapolis, you know, I had kind of jumped around on the contemporary art bandwagon for a while and have for like the last two decades since like 2000 or so have done what became known as social practice artwork. But as I said, like about 4 years after moving here, I just realized like, you know, I'm hopping to all of these different neighborhoods, these different communities, these different cities all over the world. And all of the things that I'm concerned about are happening where I live. And where is the reciprocity in how I'm operating. So I gave myself this kind of framework of doing the majority of my work within walking distance of my house, arbitrarily for a 10-year period. It's been like 11 years now. Really what it was, to get to your point, was that a lot of it is how we can create and bolster and steward social infrastructures outside of a culture of crisis. That it's so much our nature to respond to crisis, which is a highly manipulative force. But the way that we respond to crisis, which is inevitable and like you need to respond in some way, is evidenced by what you're seeing in Minneapolis right now, which is how do we relate to one another? How do we work with one another? How do we celebrate with one another? How do we learn from one another outside of spaces of crisis? And again, like I've said, this neighborhood is a perfect example of that, of people experimenting in different ways for us to figure out how to live with one another. And by living with one another, I really mean like stewarding a community of care. That is not to say that it is perfect. There's plenty of strife. There's plenty of argument, but that's human. That's fine. And it's one of the things that kind of makes me laugh when there are critiques of what's going on in Minneapolis right now and the inevitable accusation of, like, who's funding these people? How did this just occur out of nowhere? This is obviously a highly organized and well-financed campaign against the federal government. It's like, no, this is the culture of this place. Like, this is what we know. And it's because we do this work outside of the manufactured crises that power implements to manipulate us. And this is a highly manipulative historical moment.
Sam, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts today from Minneapolis.
Thank you.
That was a conversation with Sam Gould, a community organizer, artist and educator based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, speaking about the community mobilizations against the attacks on migrant communities that have been happening in the context of the ICE raids. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. We're also a podcast. Just look us up. Search Free City Radio. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week. Take care.
You're listening to CJ.